Welcome back. 21 minutes after 7, let's get into our discussions at this point in time. And as I said to you, our special guests this morning, as we try to analyze, pick apart what our finance minister had to say to us. They've both been with us on numerous occasions. And of course, this morning we welcome them back. Let's say good morning and welcome to Dr. Vanos James. Dr. James, good morning to you. Nice to have you back with us here this morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Nice to have you with us here. I know that there's a lot to discuss, and we do have as well Indira Sajeevan as part of our discussion.
Hello Indira.
I'm just trying to see if we can get her audio up and running. She'll probably join us in just a bit. Let's get the discussion started with you while we wait. Let's see what's going on there. You know, when you have these technical things, a lot of things happen at the same point in time. I'm just trying to see if we have the proper connection with Indira Sajeevan for our audio. And, of course, Dr. Vanos James is with us. Okay, Dr. James, let's begin the discussion. I'm sure that you would have had the opportunity to digest what our minister had to say and form your own opinions on all of the things, on what the budget is pegged on, the predictions for the coming financial year, a review of what transpired in 2023, and all of these things.
Provisions for Tobago.
Yes, definitely.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Satish, are you hearing me?
We're hearing you loud and clear now. Nice to have you with us here this morning.
Good morning, Vanessa. Good morning to your listeners, Satish.
Okay, so as we had Dr. James on first, we already posed a question to him. Give us your summary of what transpired. I know that Tobago featured prominently the THA chief secretary. He's not pleased at all with what's going on. Let's hear your opinion. Tell us about this budget presented yesterday and your take on it.
Well, the budget, to me, reflects, let me say, two things. First of all, the limited information that the minister works with on the nature of the development effort the country needs. So there is some reference to diversification and a whole suite of initiatives that the government has laid out here. But really, when you understand what development requires in the country, you could see that we're going to keep missing the mark. That's one thing. And in relation to that, the minister provided no assessment of where the country is now relative to the Vision 2030. Vision 2030 expected us to be developed by 2030. And if you go read the Vision 2030 document, you would see that explicitly stated. But there is no assessment of where we are relative to that. And remember, where we are there can't be calculated based on the Human Development Index. So I think this is one thing about the budget that I find to be, let me say, concerning. Secondly, the understanding of Tobago in the minister's representation is, I would say, troubling, to say the least, because he says that he's taking Farley's word on the fact that there's a recovery going on in Tobago, similar to the recovery you have going on in Trinidad after COVID. But when you look at the evidence, Tobago is in a complete collapse. So the minister had a tirade, as he usually has in his budget, about uninformed commentators, put himself in the same position with respect to Tobago. No data. He got nothing. He got no data from the THA. And he didn't bother to inquire as to the real basis on which they could say Tobago is on a recovery path. And therefore, his whole budgetary stance on Tobago is fundamentally flawed, including the allocation of a smaller portion of his budget to development efforts in Tobago, $260 million, which is really the money for parties. That's not the money for development. So this budget is very troubling from a governance standpoint. It tells you that the minister is really running an authoritarian system, and is and the real significance of that is that he's under-informed about what the country should be doing and can do to get from where we are, where we want to go, from the point of view of becoming a developed economy. Let me give you one reference point there. You're talking about a minimum of a $50,000 per person GDP per capita if you want to talk about being anywhere near those developed countries. I mean, Cayman is 90, Bermuda is 115. So they could talk about that. You can't talk about that because you, on a purchasing power parity basis, you're near 15,000, and on a nominal basis, you're at 20,000, as he said. So you're somewhere between 30,000 and overall, let's say about 60% behind where you ought to be going, and so where you ought to be. And so the budget troubles me as evidence of inadequate institutional arrangements for guiding or decision making about where we ought to be trying to go.
Let's hear from our other guest, Indira Sijiwan. Give us your summary of what our finance minister presented to us yesterday.
Satish, let me start off by saying I agree with Varnas. The budget was very, very short on the issue of development, and it speaks to our recovery, but the reality is that recovery that the minister speaks to has nothing to do with transformation of the economy. It simply has to do with the fact that there's a war going on in Ukraine and Russia, and we enjoy the benefit of higher prices for our primary export commodities, principally the petrochemicals, because most of the growth that the minister speaks to and the turnaround really comes from that aspect of the non-energy sector, that is the petrochemical industry. And in the same way that it could appear as if there has been positive growth, that could be wiped out simply by the prices of those commodities falling. So there's nothing transformational that has happened in the economy of Trinidad and Tobago over the past several years. In my view, this budget really was the launch of election 2025. It's quite contradictory in terms of many statements that the minister makes, and then how he ends up in terms of allocating the resources. He chastises the country for our heavy dependence on government's slew of subsidies, gas subsidy, low water rate, low electricity rate, no property tax, etc. He warns us that these things are coming. Property tax is coming. There's going to be an increase in the water rate, electricity rate, etc. But then, in the very next breath, there is such a heavy direction with respect to transfer payments within the budget. I think this is a year when we have seen possibly the highest ever allocation to the Ministry of Social Development. It's upward of $5 billion. And that really sends a signal. And he lists a whole set of programs to support the what he calls the those who have been the most significantly impacted by things like COVID and the fallout of high prices, etc. But I would want to say that that catchment of the society has been affected largely over a very long period of time by mismanagement and poor policy direction, and the absence of a concerted effort towards economic diversification beyond oil and gas. The budget continues to rely heavily on the energy sector. The minister spoke at length to the issue of the arrangements between Trinidad and Tobago and Venezuela as really the lifeline for the economy, because if we don't get a source of natural gas in addition to what we have, because what we have is nowhere what we need, much less a basis for increased investment, the country really is in a bad place. He mentions agriculture, and we could get into more discussions on agriculture later. He mentions tourism, but when he mentions tourism, he talks only of the CAL initiative to expand its reach throughout the Caribbean. He doesn't talk about things like the poor airlift between Trinidad and Tobago and the rest of the world, and the fact that so many airlines are not coming to Trinidad and Tobago and therefore will not have the capacity to bring visitors to our twin island states. He doesn't talk about the cost of the airlift between us and other places. He doesn't talk about the issue of crime and the extent to which crime is affecting tourism, and the fact that many of our major markets have put out advisories advising persons not to come to Trinidad and Tobago because of the situation with respect to crime. He doesn't talk in a meaningful way to product development. And I mean, I could go on and on, but you know, as we go on, we will speak more.
Well, the hot button topic before the presentation was the minimum wage. And that, of course, is because of some of the discussions that were taking place with trade unions. They want $30, and the opposition leader suggesting $25, and others in the public domain making all kind of pronouncements on minimum wage. Yesterday, we had a very intense discussion about whether or not we needed to increase the minimum wage and how much it should have gone up by. Usually, we see the minimum wage increase in increments of $2 per hour. He has taken it up by $3 per hour. Is this a step in the right direction? Is it warranted? Is it justified? Can we sustain it? Was more needed? Let's get your opinion, Dr. Vanus James.
Well, I mean, if you understand how an economy works, then you know that, and in particular, an economy like ours, with government itself being a huge host of the underemployed, in addition to those you have in retail and agriculture and so on. If you understand, if you have an economy like that, how you have to develop it, then you would know that when you try to raise the minimum wage, its platform has to be on productivity growth in the sectors where the underemployed are working. So you have to be not just talking agriculture on the face of it, but you have to be talking about agricultural productivity. So the typical farmer is earning more per day, per year, and so on, from better technologies and agricultural systems. And when you do that, you generate the upward pressures that are sustainable. As productivity grows across the economy, the minimum wage could be earned. You have to remember what a minimum wage really is. When you pay it up front, like what we're doing now, when you pay it before you do the productivity growth, it becomes kind of like a loan, and it has to be repaid by higher productivity that you have to generate down the road. So if you're going to change the minimum wage, you have to bring along with it a clear program to raise productivity across the board in the service sectors, in the retail sector, in agriculture, in government, and so on, so that the businesses that you are creating upward pressure on in terms of costs could become more productive and afford to pay the minimum wage. Otherwise, what will happen is the higher wage will just raise costs without any commensurate increase in revenues for those businesses. And the fallout of that, you never know. So I don't like the approach, although I have nothing against raising the minimum wage so poor people could get a little more money in their pocket. I'm all for that, but I'm not for that way. I think we have to be very disciplined as a country and deal with the minimum wage in a proper way by having a proper development program in place in the first instance. And this budget is very long and old talk about development and diversification, and short on substance.
Mrs. Indira Sajivan, tell us your view on the entire discussion we were having about minimum wage and what actually transpired.
Well, I will just add to what Vanessa has already said. We have to understand that people in this country are suffering. And it's not just those who are subject to minimum wage. And if we have a shrinking middle class, for example, the average person in this country does not have any, the word slips me that I'm looking for, doesn't have any extra money, really, when it comes to the people are living paycheck to paycheck. And if persons who are not, who are working a regular job is working paycheck to paycheck, can you imagine persons who are trying to survive on the minimum wage? So at the face of it, I strongly believe that the minimum wage needed to be increased from a livability perspective, because persons simply cannot at the end of the day continue to just get basic items, given what has happened with respect to the cost of living in Trinidad and Tobago. But on the other hand, I agree very strongly with Varnas that wage increases across the board needs to be attached to productivity. I mean, we keep saying this repeatedly, even when trade unions are calling for wage increases. We say, you know, the conversation has, it can't just be about asking for a salary increase, although it is really not fair that persons are in 2023 working at salaries that were negotiated a decade ago. It is unfair, but it is also unfair that we are not a society that is so structured to ensure that when persons go onto the job, that they are, that the maximum amount of productivity is being offered or and being gotten by the private sector. Of course, we will have to wait and see what the fallout of this could be, because it could potentially result in some amount of unemployment as companies that employ persons paying them the minimum wage adjust to what is happening. Because very often what we find happening is that in actuality, many companies actually pay higher than the minimum wage. So if you have a new minimum wage now, and there are some companies that may have already been paying something close to this, you may potentially have them having to increase that rate in order to keep persons. So it is a vicious cycle that we really can't have all the conversation just in these few minutes. But just in my view, suffice it to say, I believe on the one hand, it is required, but on the other hand, the inability, again, of government to ensure that it is linked to the issue of productivity could have negative impact on the cost of doing business.
Well, I can tell you for a fact that I know that some of the conglomerates, when it comes to fast food chains, they were paying $19.50 an hour already.
See? Exactly. And so that's the point.
And that's a large number of workers, because you have some of these fast food chains that have, they have franchises across the country, and it's not just one franchise, it's a set of franchise under one heading and that kind of thing. So it definitely is going to impact on them, which means that you're naive if you don't think it's going to impact on prices as well.
And Satish, I mean, I don't know if you will agree with me on this, but certainly it's something that I have noticed. Post-COVID, since the reopening of business, many of those very fast food chains, the number of staff that they used to have to serve customers have shrunken significantly.
And I think that's, I might be wrong, but I think that's because less people are buying fast food. COVID-19.
I don't think that is it as much as the fact that the cost factor has become significantly, and many of these businesses are responding to that. And the most variable factor of production is labor.
Right.
And labor tends to be the one that is hit the most when the companies have to address the issue of managing their cost of operations.
And Dr. James, what's your take on this?
Yeah, well, I could speak from experience, because I'm a part of a significant retail outfit in the country, across the country. And what we do is we tend to pay above the minimum wage, but we're always very conscious that The government is likely to be pushing the minimum wage up. So what we do is we continually try to push up productivity, training our workers. Even in retail, you know, we have highly specialized customer service training and so on that driven by the intent to push up sales performance on the part of our employees so that they could earn their wage. If you're not doing that as a business, it becomes just cost. So what this is going to do is it's going to force companies to pay attention to that strategy more and try to eke out more. We are heading more in the direction of more technology driven selling and stuff like that. All of that is going to become more urgent for companies the more you push up the minimum wage. And the substance of all that point is, look, if I were running the country, the nature of the conversation I would be having through parliamentary committees that could call hold hearings and so on and hear from the public, hear from the business community, so you could know how to calibrate your policies to drive productivity upwards. Right now, the government has no clue about how to do that because it doesn't have the information. It doesn't engage the country in that kind of conversation. You have this autocratic approach to budgeting every year where the minister comes with something the country has never seen. We had no idea what he was coming with. Every year it's a big surprise. And then he costs everybody for commenting before he put out the budget. That sort of approach is dysfunctional. And we need to clean it up, because this approach to the minimum wage tells you the real underlying problem is poor quality governance that leads to continual hit and miss. And it's why $20? Why not $25? Mm-hmm. If you don't have proper arrangements to know what businesses can do and should do and to put policies in place to encourage them to do it, then it's miss.
Mm.
And this is likely to be missed again and generate what Indira is saying, potential unemployment fallouts.
Well, you know, when we had the discussion on minimum wage yesterday, just before the budget, we were discussing how many people actually benefit from this and how much of the workforce is paid minimum wage. The finance minister put forward a figure of 200,000 people benefit from or are paid minimum wage. What's your view on that figure? Is that a realistic figure? Let's just put ladies first this time around. Messenger, what do you think? Do you really think 200,000 people in the workforce work for minimum wage?
I mean, again, we're just trying to guess out the top of our head, because again, data collection is not something that we are known for. But when you consider the fact that the services sector has been growing significantly, the distribution sector in Trinidad and Tobago is quite significant. And we have our labor force is 600,000. I would just simply say I think it is substantial. There are a substantial number of persons when you look at the size of the distributor sector in Trinidad and Tobago and services on the whole that are actually employed. We're looking at all of the fast food chains, the retail businesses, we look supermarkets, etc. We're looking at tourism in many aspects of tourism. You will have that. So it's a substantial number of persons who work here. But the minister did say I wouldn't want to call it in defense, but to be honest, he did talk about some possible initiatives to be rolled out in 2024 to upskill persons that fall under this category of the minimum wage. You know, the way in which that's going to be rolled out, of course, we have to all wait and see. The extent to which it's going to be linked to labor force needs is another thing. Are you going to ensure that you do it for those sectors that actually employ those persons? I'm not sure how he intends to roll that out. Maybe it will unfold as the budget go on, but you know he also said that he did consult widely to come up with this. In fact, the Minister of Energy on a program I was on last night said this was to 20.5 was the sweet spot in terms of balancing all of the various demands for the wage increase, whether they actually did calculate whether it was a live, where people can actually live on it. I am not sure. I am not privy to what happens behind closed doors, but it is what it is. But you know, I mean, there is so much more for us to discuss as well, Satish. It was a lot.
Yeah, it is. Dr. James, quickly, your opinion on this 200,000 people benefiting from minimum wage.
Well, I see the CSO's data and I try to analyze it from a wide range of perspectives to estimate the scale of underemployment, for example. And by and large, I would say that's not far from the mark. You know, in my company, about 10% of the employees are not at minimum, we're just above, but close enough. The lowest earners are about 10%. And if you take that across, say retail alone, you will end up with quite a number of cases. So the CSO data is pretty closely in line with that 200,000 out of the overall labor force. I wouldn't quibble with that if that's the official estimate myself. Yeah. The thing is, though, the approach of the minister on training and so on is what I call hit and miss. The conversation that you've undertaken is with a few people, and it's not designed in a way that anybody who wants to participate could participate. I mean, we have a substantial interest in my company in participating in that conversation. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know the minister. And I'm a professional studying this thing every day for my company. So my point is, you've got to set up the system, the arrangements via the parliament. So these are routine, regular hearings that are being held, and any company could prepare its data, prepare its presentations and so on, and go to the country and say, this is what I am experiencing, and this is how your policy making would help me. And if that is the way we're doing it, we'd get better information than you could get from a CSO survey. Now, that's my point about what the minister is doing. Even when you're using CSO data, you're likely to get fundamentally flawed policy because you don't have, you're underinformed, and so so you know I'm generally not happy with the approach that we are continually using in this country, this autocratic approach to policy making. It is going to mean we cannot fundamentally develop the economy and take these poor people out of poverty through continual increases in the productivity of the activities in which they are engaged.
There's so much
which more. Which is the real story, you know. That's really the issue.
Yeah, in fact, Satish, it's much like, I would parallel that to the $500 million that the minister supposedly allocated to agriculture, some special projects in agriculture last year, to programs called Youth Homestead and Youth Shade Houses and Youth Something Else program. And it would appear that it's the best kept secret in terms of how those who are currently in the program ended up in it. There was no wide advertising. There didn't seem to be any mechanism that the public or those involved in the sector could have been involved in order to arrive at one, what the program should be, how it should be structured for best effect, and who are the persons who should be the ones in it. And the way I see it, it will be could potentially be a repeat of so many programs we've had in the past where we have given out lands to persons for agriculture, but they have no experience in agriculture, and we end up in a situation where taxpayers' money spent and, you know, nothing happened in terms of increasing the production of food in the country.
Yeah, we need to take
that's an important point, yeah. Satish, Indira, and I want to supplement that point with another hit and miss in agriculture. Remember a couple of years ago when the minister came up with and the Minister of Agriculture in particular came up with a basket of projects for post-harvest technologies, and they thought that would be the fundamental basis on which we'll deal with all national food security issues. no reporting, no continuous monitoring. Correct. Nobody knows what is happening to these programs, and they're spending huge sums of national money.
Correct.
So India's point is well on top.
And in fact, the minister's now said he's now, in this fiscal year coming, there'll be another $400 million again spent on God alone knows what, because at the end of the day, we will hear nothing about it.
Yeah. We need to take a couple messages to take us up to the top to news. And after the 8 o'clock news, there's so much more for us to discuss. We want to get the budget pegged on an oil price of $85, gas $5 MMBTU, a fiscal deficit projected $5.19 billion. Is that realistic? Are we going to see more? What about the allocations to the various ministries? Crime in particular, people want to know, well, how are we going to deal with this thing? And so much more when we get back after the 8 o'clock news with our special guests here this morning. And of course, we'll be taking some of your calls as well. We are speaking this morning, if you're now joining us, with Indira Sajeevan and Dr. Vanas James. Some messages to take us up to the top, then news. Stay with us.
This is the Morning Rumble with Satish Mahabir.
3.5 minutes after 8, into the final hour of our show here this morning. We're picking apart what our finance minister had to say to us, and none better than our two guests here this morning, Indira Sajeevan and Dr. Vanas James. Let's take a couple of your calls before we get back into our discussions. Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning, Satish. Good morning, Dr. Vanas James, Miss Indira Sajeevan. I wasn't wrong when subsidies were first introduced. But I like to believe that at that time, that moment in our history, the persons who put that together had an intention that it was meant as a temporary measure and was largely designed to ensure that the recipients would use that extra cash to put their house in order so that at some point in time in the future, they'd be able to turn to the central government and say to them, corporation soul, thanks but no thanks. We no longer need this. I don't feel as though that has happened, and it has caused the subsidy, the various subsidies, to be perpetuated over a medium to long term, and I don't see any end in sight. It accounts for a very large slice of the national pie, and it would be well with us if we were to put things in place to either reduce or altogether eliminate the need for subsidizing some of these people, your WASAs, your Caribbean Airlines, and your TNTEX, so all these different subsidies, persons who receive subsidies. Dr. Vanas James and Ms. Indira Sajeevan Ali, if I called both of you all in my capacity as Prime Minister and said to the both of you all, I want you all to set in place a sequence of events and measures that are designed to reduce these various organizations' dependence on subsidies. I would like to know how you would go about that. Thank you very much.
Quite a question. it is. Let's ladies first. Indira Sajeevan, tell us.
Well, I was going to allow.
Okay.
Dr. James to go first. But anyway, that's cool. I could do that. You know, the thing is, successive governments have used a model of dependency to keep the people of Trinidad and Tobago where we are. And they have used the largesse from the energy sector in order to, in fact, support many of these subsidization programs that the gentleman spoke of. One of the first things I would do is I would say, because there are different subsidies there, so we need to kind of categorize them. There are the subsidies that have come to us through state enterprises in the name of the subsidized water rate, electricity rate, that we are paying. With respect to those specifically, I would say that the state has used these entities not just to provide subsidies to consumers, but also in order to create jobs for the boys. So to me, the first order of business would be to clean up these institutions and to apply proper business practices within them in order to make them operationally effective. That is the first thing. One of the other things, if we take water, for example, the minister talked about the high consumption rate in Trinidad and Tobago. But is that truly the consumption rate, or is it that how much of that consumption rate is water that is simply lost because of, pipe bursting in the roads? And we know these things sometimes go on for days and days. So data analysis, understanding, really, truly understanding what reaches consumers is the other issue that I think we need to address with respect to those subsidies. So that's the second thing. The third thing, especially in the time that we live in now, yes, we have enjoyed very low electricity rate for a very long time. But in the time that we live in now, given the whole drive globally towards renewable energies, even as I am understanding that rate needs to go up, if for fossil fuel electricity, I would want to offer the citizenry alternatives, and I would want to reshape my and transform my economy to allow both individuals and businesses to be able to have access to alternative sources of energy. And while we may be wanting and talking about solar farms and wind farms down the road, and everything always seems to be coming into this very future that never arrives, it's happening right now where there are solar panels globally that are available, and I would want to get into some kind of program where I would use my power of the state to be able to source solar panels, for example, at as low a possible cost that I can, bring it in at the scale that is necessary to and provide fiscal incentives to individuals and to businesses to allow them to move towards alternative sources of energy. I would want to move to a situation where I can ensure that they could sell any surplus back into the grid. So that would be my approach to that. On the issue of subsidies that come in the form of handouts, now, governments use that in order to keep people dependent on them, keep them voting on them. And unfortunately, the way they measure success, and I have seen this over the many years I've been analyzing economic policy and particularly budgets, they tend to define success by increasing the number of people that they are able to support through these programs, which I believe is incorrect. It should be the reverse. It should be success through transfer payments should be measured by the number of people we wean off of this program, which requires that we link the beneficiaries of social programs, we link them into sustainable opportunities for retraining, retooling, etc., to ensure that they can, within the shortest possible time, be weaned off of these programs. But it's a chicken and egg situation. If the economy that we are in is not generating employment opportunities, and herein lies the largest problem. So in terms of my role in the government would be to support the government in terms of economic diversification and the growing of productive sectors in areas that can generate jobs. Now, listen, I'm a broken record calling for economic diversification beyond oil and gas since in the public space since about 2006. We are in 2023 now. That is well over the number of years that is required in order for a new and emerging sector to become sustainable. Yet here we are in 2023, still talking about the sectors that we need to grow in order to have a diversified economy. So unless we stop the old talk and start to actually do the transformation, then the subsidies will continue as they are in place.
Yeah, Dr. James, subsidies, much ado about nothing, or something that we really need to do something about?
Well, I mean, the modern world is a little bit different to when the issues were originally raised. I was there as a young fella back in 1969, for example, in the third five-year development plan. The subsidies had three roles along the lines of what Indira is talking about. One of them, of course, is to underwrite the sustainability of the public utilities. That was thought of as an obligation to provide energy and water and and even telephone services in those days to the public at an affordable cost, bearing in mind that you have to care about poor people's ability to enjoy these facilities. And the other part of it had to do with the competitiveness of businesses. So there were a whole basket of subsidies in the five-year plan that was introduced to help keep business costs down and allow them to compete more appropriately and successfully in the local and international market. That was another class of subsidies. And then, of course, you had what we falsely call subsidies nowadays, which is really what Indira is calling the transfer payments to households. Those are really transfer payments and not cost-reducing subsidies as the term was originally intended to be used. Now, the way I would approach this is to, first of all, put the public utilities under proper parliamentary oversight. They too are underinformed in their pricing strategies, so to say, and even in terms of their efficiencies and so on. Now, you can't know in the current environment what to make of it because you don't have the data. Indira might know more about it than I do, but I could tell you, I can't make head or tail of the viability of these agencies because I can't see any information that allows me to make the judgment. Now, parliamentary oversight would fix that problem, and then we will have a better set of decisions, plus continuous scrutiny and continuous accountability that will allow us to gradually improve the performance of the agencies and maybe bring their costs more and more in line with what makes economic sense for the country. So that's the first thing that I would worry about. Now, on the company and the business subsidies, you have to remember that in the modern day under WTO rules, we're very restricted in the way we subsidize competitive businesses, especially those that are involved in international trade. So there, what do you do? Well, that's where your development program comes in, and that's where efforts to drive up competitiveness in trade and so on would matter in allowing your companies to be more competitive and therefore not necessarily in need of the scale of subsidies that we had in mind in the five-year plans that I grew up with. On the household transfer payments, to me, a big deficit, I think the minister began to try to address it yesterday, a big deficit in the country is that you really have to have adequate, well-informed means testing. So you need to do the living standard surveys and the household budgetary surveys regularly enough to know who are underwater and need transfers. And so Jamaica has done a great job of continually monitoring the living standards of households year in, year out. We have not done that greater job, and we need to clean that up partly by keeping our word and establishing real capacity in the CSO, the statistical institute they're talking about, so we can have continuous monitoring of the living standards of the households all across the country. And in that context, it is worth pointing out that it needs to be done, and it needs to be done as a professional matter. I remember in the census of 2010, when the income component of the census was left out on racial grounds, because the government at the time didn't want anybody to know. That's the government going into the 2010 census. This is under Manning in those days. Didn't want the country to know the racial distribution of income across the country. So they took out the whole income module of the census. And now you're going to need an independent agency that is capable of doing the work and letting the country know all the facts, who poor, who not poor, who deserves subsidies and so on, so who deserves transfers. And then you rig up the transfer payments around that data, as we've done with a very professional team I participated in Jamaica's case. So for now, what we have is a more politically driven approach to the transfers. And I guess that's understandable in a situation where you have inadequate information. But we need to move quickly away from this amateurish approach to running our country and clean up the information on the basis of which we're making decisions about subsidies with respect to Wassa and Tiantech, subsidies with respect to the companies that are competing on the global stage, and transfer payments to households. That would be the broad approach I would adopt. And therefore, I would tell, just to tell you quickly, I would tell the minister, whoever minister asks me that, I would say, no professional could make proper policies on the basis of expert information developed with statistical data. Mm. We need to set up the country in a way that all the information is available for public judgment and parliamentary representative evaluation of what is the best way to deal with these issues.
Yeah,
we're messing around with that.
There are some nitty-gritty issues that we need to get to, and it's amazing how the time gets away from us. It's almost 20 past 8 already. We've been talking for an hour. Our finance minister, he gave us some predictions. He pegged the budget on a price of $85 per barrel for oil, $5 per MMBTU for gas. He's expecting a budget deficit of $5.197 billion. Realistic? Is he being conservative? What's your opinion? Anyone who wants to go first on this one?
Well, reasonable. I think those are fairly realistic in terms of where I see oil and gas prices going. I've been monitoring it for a while. Reasonable. And the impact on the budget is just a mathematical calculation. The impact on the deficits and so on, given the amount of expenditure you want to undertake. So the real story of the deficit part of it has to do really with what you are planning to do on the expenditure front. The minister plans to spend $6.2 billion on a very weak development program, and therefore the bulk of the $59 billion budget is continuous recurrent spending. You can't move the Trinidad and Tobago economy forward on that basis. So whatever the targeting they're doing, it's reasonable from the point of view of the behavior of the oil and gas prices, but it's rigged around a very inadequate approach to transforming the economy in the way Indira says. By the way, Indira, when I was a little boy, we used to be talking about economic diversification. You know? I grew up under the longest teaching.
Exactly.
The whole story.
That, of course, it's a very old story. If I could just weigh in on this, I would. I feel the price of oil was reasonable. I feel that he pitched the price of gas a bit high, because you know, in terms of my looking at the trends in the price of natural gas, it has been trending closer to around $3 per MMBTU. So and gas is really our major item. Whether the minister is able to realize his revenue has a lot to do with and he said it with respect to, you know, he's very vulnerable to the companies that are bringing the natural gas to market. And so far in the last several years, we have seen many challenges in terms of what they project, the actual amount of gas falling short of what many of these companies are projecting. So that will impact on his revenue stream. You talk particularly about the $6.2 billion that he's identified under the PSIP. But when you look at the trend in Trinidad and Tobago, regardless of what you budget for development, our capacity to implement on an annual basis doesn't seem to be above $3.5 billion. I think it's only during COVID that it was able to go, I think, close to $4 billion. And that's in large part because, you know, necessity becomes the mother of all. So that you can say you want to spend $6.2 billion, but if you don't have the implementation capacity to do it, as Trinidad economy has shown, you know, you will not have it happening and you may have the diversion of much of that resources again towards the whole issue of recurrent expenditure.
When we look at the...
May I just weigh in quickly there on that point? That's a very important point, Satish, that Indira is raising. And I think the reason for the implementation deficit around the PSIP really has to do with what you're trying to do there and who is going to be doing the work. If it's just focused on local capabilities, ministry capabilities, and even the local private sector, you're dead in the water. You've got to have a PSIP that is linked to the evolution of your approach to foreign direct investment in the country. That's where you're going to be building up implementation capabilities in a competitive market environment. That's fundamentally flawed in the country today because all the FDI is really coming into oil and gas. So that for me needs to be dealt with if you're going to fix the problem that Indira put a finger on.
Yeah.
And if I could add to that, so the minister in his budget, she said Trinidad and Tobago, we are the second most attractive destination for investment. But the minister didn't tell us in the last, let's say, 10 years what foreign investment has in fact come into this country. The fact is that most of the foreign investment that we have had coming into Trinidad and Tobago has been in the oil and gas sector. And since 2010, which was when we had the AUM project, we have not really had any major investment. There's no basis for investment to come into that sector, largely because it is based on the availability of natural gas. And we don't have natural gas available to justify any new investment. We can't even support the existing plants we have, much less going forward. Now, the minister talked about hydrogen in terms of a green economy. He talked about that. We know that we have, I think, what the Minister of Energy says is the largest solar plant in the region that is now ongoing. But other than those things, foreign investment is simply not coming into Trinidad and Tobago. And again, the data bears me out when I look at the at what has been happening with foreign direct investment coming into Trinidad and Tobago. It has been on a steady decline since about 2010.
And all of those are pretty interesting indicators. When we look at some of the allocations made by the Minister of Finance, you try to paint a picture in your mind of what's the government's agenda for the financial year to come. And when we look at some of the allocations made, education and training getting the largest subvention, that's $8.02 billion. Then you have health and you have national security, and it goes down. Works and transport getting a significant amount, $3.39 billion. And it goes down public utilities and everything else. What's the picture you think that's painted for us if we were to read between the lines with the government's agenda? We know that an election is on the horizon, but this major allocation to education, we often speak about crime. And whether or not we're seeing value for money and so on with the allocations to national security. But are we seeing those things with the allocations to education?
Let me give you a comment so that Indira can have the last word. Two things. One, piggyback on what Indira was saying there. One measure of the inadequacy of the approach to FDI is that no FDI goes to Tobago, where a huge part of the tourism potential lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big measure of the lopsided approach we have to foreign direct investment in the country. By lacking a proactive wealth or through development program, diversification program, you are underutilizing a huge part of your potential as it exists on the tourism platform Tobago has. So that's a huge significant thing. Now on the allocations, the signal thing that the country has to pay attention to is that it's okay to allocate the bulk of your or a huge part to education and healthcare and so on. The problem with that is that's for the local market. You're just talking about education of the local community, healthcare excellence for the local community and so on. You're not talking about exportable education, exportable healthcare, exportable financial sector and so on. And once you're not talking about that, you're not going anywhere with the development program, because for a country like Trinidad and Tobago, you can't be talking about development through the production and export of airplanes. You have to be talking about development through the production and export of education, bringing people into the country on a long stay basis to go to school, just the way we pack our bags and go to Harvard and Cambridge. And the same would be true for healthcare. And even the way we approach our creative industries, all fundamentally flawed. And were it not for the cleverness of the musicians, they too would be focusing on the local market. Good for them. They build their industry around exports. So it's that you have to put into the understanding of the allocations. They're good, they're big, but they're not going to get you development.
I mean, I concur with everything that you're saying, and I just want to add, you know, you talk about Tobago and the absence of the investment in our tourism product. And you're very right, because I've just done some work in Dominica, St. Vincent and Grenada, and it is quite amazing the amount of investment that is coming in, foreign direct investment in their tourism product, to build out infrastructure in terms of hotels, etc. And why isn't Tobago, which is as beautiful, if not even more so, why aren't we seeing that in a Tobago? So I totally agree with you on the issue of education. I want to say this tongue in cheek, that, you know, we are in fact exporting based on our education model, because we are training and we are graduating thousands of young people supposedly to develop Trinidad and Tobago, but there are no jobs for them, and therefore they are of their own free will expatriating themselves to other countries where they are finding opportunities to contribute to the development of those countries. Because, as you are saying, we simply have missed the boat, and there's a disconnect between our education system and our development model. So that, Satish, I am as perplexed as you with respect to this particular very high allocation to education, because even as it is, we are churning out graduates, we're ticking boxes, but jobs are not available. I met a young nurse who finished her training in 2019, just before COVID, and we're now post-COVID, and she has not been able to find employment. She's been sitting down for 2 years and not been able to get the practical experience that she needs, having completed the nursing training program. And there's so many of these stories, so many young people who have finished their courses of study but cannot find jobs because of disconnect. But if you do not know where you want to take your country from a development perspective, how then can you align your education system to ensure that you are producing the skills that are required in order to feed into that? We have the legacy and the nostalgia for the oil and gas sector. So we continue to churn out engineers in large numbers, but that sector is now on the decline, and more we're hearing about persons being unemployed, being put on the unemployment block, as companies contract, as more and more companies go towards Guyana, etc. So that is not happening. And yes, the model that Vance is talking about in terms of producing, restructuring education for the export market, restructuring healthcare. So we've talked about health tourism. It's been on the cards. It's been called various things by various administration, but we have done nothing to further that initiative in any meaningful way, notwithstanding the fact that we have many advantages that makes us an ideal location for something like medical tourism, but we have simply failed to position ourselves to take advantage. Sports tourism is another one we could talk about. We have so much infrastructure that is simply lying idle for most of the year, and we are not using the opportunity to transform it into exportable type commodities.
You know, it's interesting we're having this discussion about education with this allocation, because I remember some time ago I had a conversation with Basdeo Pandey about education and about his thinking back then for dollar for dollar and how he expected it to work given where he wanted the country to go. And one of the things that he lamented in that interview was that education has now become a cash cow. and that education is no longer tied into the development. And he's making very much what he made back then, the same analogies that you're making now, and that I think many of us can agree. We are qualifying people and certifying them for things that, for jobs and opportunities that simply just don't exist. And there does not seem to be this realignment with the country's path where we wanted to go, wherever that is. It just does not seem as though we have made that shift. We've gone way past the time that I'm supposed to have both of you because the conversation is so engaging, and we've just barely scratched the top of some of the things that we need to delve into. We haven't spoken about energy and all of these things. But as we come close to the end of our interview here this morning, many times when we have these discussions take place at a certain level. I'm not saying that the conversation is one that people can't understand, but understanding is one thing, associating is another. So yesterday we had this budget presentation for close to $60 billion. And the average person may ask what seems to be the obvious question to them. Well, you know, how is this thing really impacting on me? Is my cost of living going to go up? Life going to get more expensive? Is it going to get cheaper? Am I going to benefit? Is my quality of life going to improve? So as we wrap up here, let me get that from both of you, because that's really, in a sense, what matters to the people. This budget presentation that column member take 4 hours on something to present, at the end of the day, what's in it for me? So which one of you wants to go first in trying to explain to the people whether or not there are things in it for them, and what they can expect in their daily life moving forward?
Well, let me go first to keep with my original intent to give Indy ready last. No, by piggybacking on a point Indy is making, what's in it for me? If we keep going the way we're going, what is going to happen is that the emigration of skills is going to raise the living standards of countries to which those workers go, while keeping down living standards growth in Trinidad and Tobago. That will widen the gap and encourage more immigration. And the effect of all of that is that living standards in the country, on a dynamic basis, living standards in the country will stay down. And that's a deep-seated effect of the approach to budgeting that we've adopted here. Whatever else is in it for you in terms of gas and oil prices, you better watch that effect, because its consequences are sustained suppression of the development prospects for the country.
You know, Satish, the question that you're asking, I've thought about it long and hard. You know, I'm going to be speaking at some school budget events, and which I particularly like, really much more so than speaking at the business forums, because I feel that most of these forums are really about pandering to government rather than being very realistic to what this budget means for the country and for the people of Trinidad and Tobago. And I want young people to understand it. And I'm thinking about that, you know, what does this budget hold for these young people that I'm going to talk to during the course of this week? And I'm somewhat stumped in terms of what I can see to them, because a budget, while it's an annual fiscal statement in terms of revenue and expenditure, it is way more than that. A national budget is a tool of development of a government. It is the tool of government that is supposed to be located within your longer-term development plan. And it's supposed to tell us on an annual basis, how have you spent a large amount of money, close to $60 billion in this instance, to take us closer to achieving our development goals. And when I look at budgets that have the pattern of the budgets over the years, and I look at this one and I try to answer, how is this budget going to take us closer to achieving economic transformation where jobs can be available to these young people? They could see a future. They could see quality of life. I can't tell you that I have much that is positive to say to them, because for me, at the end of the day, we would have spent close to $60 billion at the end of this fiscal year that we're coming into, and we would have moved the dial no closer took Trinidad and Tobago being in a better place. And that is very, very, it is very disappointing to me. It is very disheartening to me as somebody who spends a lot of time thinking about development, thinking about the future of the country and the future of young people in this country. And I'm not sure what to say anymore. It is frustrating. It was painful actually listening to that 4+ hours presentation yesterday. I mean, didn't even get to talk about agriculture, but you talk so much about food security and its importance. And if you understand the world is going in terms of the global food crisis that is already upon us and the fact that it's going to worsen significantly going forward. And then you give agriculture $1.4 billion, most of which, about 90% of which, is for recurrent expenditure. So you have done really nothing to address the need to achieve the objective that you yourself start of saying we need to achieve, which is food security. So we're spinning top in mud very much. With the approach that we're taking to budgeting and development as a whole, Satish, and that continues to worry me, and it should worry every citizen in Trinidad and Tobago. For those who are celebrating that, yes, they are going to get a lot of handouts in this budget, at the end of the handouts, then what?
Mm, yeah. So I think that's where we're going to leave it this morning, for the average citizen to figure out to themselves and evaluate after all that comes into play, because we're talking about increases in essentials, your water, your electricity, your property tax, your regular taxes for those people who might get away for whatever reason. The promise is that when this revenue authority is implemented, people who ain't paying their tax now and probably have more disposable income will have that because of the taxation. So there's a lot that's going to come into play. And I'm positive that we're going to have further discussions with both of you as we go along. And we keep monitoring the opposition leader's responses on Friday. It'd be interesting to hear what she has to say and probably analyze some of what she may have put forward as well. I want to thank both of you for being with us here this morning, giving us your insight into some of these very, very tricky topics. It was always my pleasure having both of you here with us this morning.
All right. Have a nice day, Satish.
Thank you, yes.
And that, of course, ladies and gentlemen, my very, very special guests this morning, the morning after the budget presentation, Indira Sajivan and Dr. Varnas James. 20 minutes before 9. A couple messages. When we get back, I've got some of your messages sent into our WhatsApp number. And a couple of your calls as well. Stay with us.